Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 85 featuring Andy Wasler. Do you know who Andy is, Lon?
A little bit, but...
Maybe I should fill you in?
Yeah.
Andy was my first supervisor at Digital Domain. So he was like my first boss in visual effects. And it was kind of cool because he actually came from architecture. He is an architect. He went to SciArc.
So you guys spoke the same lingo.
We spoke the same lingo, and probably a big reason why I got hired in the interview process. We actually reminisce about my interview. Apparently, according to him, is one of the shortest interviews he ever had. It was kind of fun. What's cool also about Andy is that he went from architecture and then left to go into visual effects.
That sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, but what he did that's different than anyone else is he left VFX and went back to architecture, and now is a designer.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You can't take the sci-arc out of the guy. I mean...
That's true. He's a really cool guy. He's very, very humble. He's not going to talk much about what the awesome things he did. He talks a little bit about a little experimental animation company he worked on. For those of you who want to look up more on that information, it's actually something called Propellerhead Design. And one of the other founders of that is J.J. Abrams.
Fantastic.
So, really, really cool, group of guys came out of that, including Andy. And Andy also helped design Bad Robot's office. Surprise, surprise.
See, it's all connected.
So we talk a lot about architecture and about how actually his visual effects, we always talk about how architecture influences visual effects, but what's also interesting is how visual effects affects his architecture now and how much more informed he is about studio life and everything else. And a lot of things that he designs now are actual production studios and post-production studios because he kind of understands that workflow and how that works. Really cool stuff. Really great designer. He's sending a couple of images of some of the great things that he's designed. Talk a lot about problem solving and then dive into, of course, virtual reality, which is another great topic for us.
Perfect combination of skill sets there.
Yeah, exactly.
Save us from crappy VR. I'm going to say it over and over again. Please, for the love of God, don't make me see a bunch of crappy VR.
I know.
Great VR is awesome.
Yep.
Crappy VR is terrible.
Yeah. I mean, why go into an incredible virtual reality experience and feels like you're going into a Taco Bell?
Yeah. Or the stupid Netflix cabin.
Oh, it's so ugly.
I mean, not that, you know, going to a lodge would be bad, but no, this is the Netflix lodge.
There are better designs to go to.
It's terrible. Sorry if you worked on that. I apologize.
All right, guys. I don't think we have any other big announcements. I think our website's coming out very, very soon, our new website.
Very soon.
Very soon. Lon's been making sure all of those nuts and bolts are in place, so it's been really exciting to see that. So be on the lookout for a new ChaosCrypt.com coming up very, very soon.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
It's been... I think since iRobot that we've seen each other. No, we've seen each other a little bit. Since you quit the industry, we've seen each other like once.
I'm old and I don't remember things well. So it's entirely possible that it's been that long.
I think you had built your house on Venice Beach.
Yes.
Do you still live there?
I do.
That's an awesome house.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. We moved and then we moved back.
Oh, you moved out and moved back?
Yeah, it's not that interesting of a story. We did it to get our kids into a good public school.
Oh, okay.
And then we outgrew the little house we were in and moved back to Venice. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, Venice doesn't necessarily have a good public school.
Not an elementary school, no.
Yeah. We did that with my kids. We thought we were going to be in a great neighborhood. We lived in Toluca Lake, right?
Yeah,
it's great. But it's a really small neighborhood next to a not so great neighborhood, and sure, that's where you would normally go to school.
Yeah.
And it turns out everyone in Toluca Lake just goes to private school. So I was like, oh, well, that's not going to work for us because we're not rich like most people in Toluca Lake. Yeah. So, but my wife works in Burbank, so we were able to get a school permit.
Oh, nice.
To go there.
Good.
And then that worked for a while, but then my wife didn't want to be tied to her job, so we ended up just moving to Burbank.
Okay. So you spend a lot of time in the car.
I do spend a lot. You know what I do when I spend in the car? I listen to podcasts.
Nice. I like it.
That's how it all started.
All right.
I was listening to enough good podcasts that I was saying, I think I can do this.
I'm sure you're killing it.
Yeah.
Come on.
I think I can do it. And I think what I've started to realize is how much work I have to do. And I say, okay, what's the least amount of work I can do to make this work?
Really? I suspect you're the kind of guy who needs to do it really well.
I do, but I want to do it well for the least amount. There's an efficiency thing.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't want to – okay, let's go back to this. Let's go to that story of A Day After Tomorrow.
Oh, dear.
Which is where you and I first
met. I remember that day when we met.
Yeah, and we can talk about that. But do you remember specifically about that thing about how much work to do? How much work was involved in the ambient occlusion pipeline that we developed on Day After Tomorrow when I was going, there's got to be a simpler way.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like there was something fun about inventing the wheel every time you did a show because there was always something new and, you know, there was that sort of young energy of, hey, let's do the new thing, right? Let's beat the other guys and let's get there first. And there, so I remember sort of every time we started something, trying to come up with some sort of pipeline to make it work.
Right.
And everything was kludged together.
Yeah. Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. Okay, so let's go back because this is a story I've told, and now you should be present in the story. What was the first you said the first day you remember meeting me?
We were in the warehouse building in that little conference room in the back.
Yep.
And there was 78 different things happening, and we were trying to ramp up quickly. And we had what must be the shortest interview in history. I mean, it could, the whole thing couldn't have lasted more than 10 minutes. And
I think it was about 10 minutes.
Yeah. And I remember at the end,
I had no idea what happened after 10 minutes. I had no idea. Like, did that go okay?
I don't know. I kind of remember at the end some version of a conversation where it was sort of like you were saying, I haven't done production, but I think I could be good at it. And we had sort of shared the architecture background and the sort of the similar sensibilities. And I remember just sort of thinking, yeah, let's try this out.
Right.
And the rest is history.
It's true. And I've mentioned this a couple times about Digital Domain. Digital Domain was always the company that gave people a chance that most people would on paper just dismiss all the time.
Oh, yeah. That's my whole story there.
Yeah.
I mean, they were so generous with me, which I still don't understand why I had the opportunities that I did there. But I'm grateful.
What is your story there?
Vernon Wilbert
hired
me to be on the Whoville team for Grinch.
Right.
And that must have been 1999.
Okay.
It was a great team. It was me, Vernon, Howie, Gaku. Oh, I'm going to forget someone. Kevin. I don't even remember everyone's last names. Anyway, it was a great team. It was very fun. It was a sort of – there was a kind of an innocence to the way we were building everything, but I don't remember who the production designer was, but there was a little bit of generosity in terms of having some leeway to actually do some design stuff, which didn't happen often.
Mm-hmm.
I found that the digital artists, I think, tended to sort of get treated more like machines and less like artists, right, at least back then. But we had some fun. We made some cool shots, and that was a great it was a great group of people. Matthew Butler and Brian Grill were the supervisors, and I just, you know, one thing led to another. I kept coming back for more shows, and then eventually got put on staff.
Okay. But that was 99.
Yes.
And so you and I got together in 2002.
Yes.
So that was in 3 years. You went from your was Didi your first job in VFX?
Because
you did architecture before that.
I did a lot of different things. I did architecture. I did feature animation, which was I think that was sort of my transition into
VFX.
VFX. Some friends and I kind of started kicking around this idea that we could do 3D animation while sort of images and before Toy Story kind of happened, mm-hmm. but while we were sort of hearing that there was this thing happening, a 3D animated uh-huh. feature. And, you know, I was playing with Mac software. I think it was something called like StrataVision.
Yeah.
And it was great, you know, it was amazing, but it was limited by sort of, you know, hardware limitations.
Sure.
You couldn't get a lot done. So anyway, me and three other guys got together, and one of them had access to the lab at USC, mm-hmm. and that was my introduction to Silicon Graphics machines. And then I was taught by one of these other guys, Softimage.
Right.
And that was sort of – that was the real sort of ramp into visual effects was this kind of idea that maybe a couple of guys could start up an animation company. And we went through some iterations, and we spent some time with HBO and with DreamWorks and actually did, you know, a little kind of pooled our money and the literal sort of garage band thing. We leveraged some relationships and borrowed four SGIs, which was, you know, more than most houses cost at the time.
Like 50 grand a piece.
Yeah, it could have even been more. And then the software was
another 50 grand.
Yeah. I mean, it was huge amounts of money. And
I think
and
it was like $250,000 almost to set a system up.
Yeah. Which was incredibly cool at the time because it was so sort of precious. And so we did that. We did a test, some character stuff. One of the guys was more of a character guy. I did the environmental stuff, and you know, we sort of came together. Another guy was sound, music, writing, and it was really fun. You know, it was sort of this youthful kind of, well, let's see what we can do, kind of environment, and that, you know, led to some really interesting stuff, and eventually got me to Digital Domain.
But you had started an animation company.
I started a I mean.
But what were you? What did you guys? You guys had a plan in mind in terms of what you were going to do with your animation?
We were kind of. I don't know how to describe it. The sort of wave of startups and hey, you know, the democratization of all of this technology. Uh-huh. We kind of were sort of excited by that, and we thought, well, you don't need all this other sort of baggage and infrastructure to be a studio. We could become this sort of micro studio. We wanted to make stuff, you know, and we were nerdy and we were like, oh, this is cool. Let's do 3D animation because that's a new thing.
Yep.
So that was sort of that was the impetus. There was no sort of 5-year plan. You know, when you're in your 20s and you're kind of staying up all night playing with a keyboard and
you're just
kind of doing stuff.
Yep.
But it was a very interesting ride.
Yeah, so that was the same kind of thing with you. It was like you just started this stuff, and then Didi says, "Let's hire this guy."
Yeah. I mean, I knew some people, and someone brought me in. You know, someone recommended me, So Vernon was sort of the linchpin.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so, like I said, so 1999 to 2002. That's only 3 years between when you got hired at Digital Domain and then. You were already a CG supervisor and hiring people in 3 years.
So after Grinch, I hope I can get this right. After Grinch, I think I was on Time Machine.
Okay.
And David Prescott was my supervisor. And I don't remember exactly how it went down. But there were some complications during production, mm-hmm. and then there was a big meeting, mm-hmm. and a lot of people were being let go. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, geez, you know, I got a mortgage. I got to figure out. And I remember going to David and saying, hey, you know, should I be nervous about this? And he's like, well, actually, there's this thing that's happening. And it turned out they were doing this huge sort of time-lapse shot.
Right.
And he's like, I want you to be the shot lead for this like 30-second or 60-second.
Yeah, it's like a big montage shot, right?
Yeah, it's like a transition from, you know, the 18 – I have to apologize to all the people who worked on Time Machine, but from, you know, when the movie takes place into the future, and it's sort of this slow pull out of his lab up watching the city get built and then pulling up past a Constellation, I think that was the name of the plane, and then past the International Space Shuttle. And it was a really sort of fun thing. And and David kind of, he said to me, look, I want you to sort of run the shot. And Brian Grill was there and sort of kind of kept everybody in line. And sort of he was the sort of patriarch figure. Mm-hmm. But the shot came out great and everyone was happy. And so that was sort of the next step for me. And then after that, I feel like there should have been one more show before Day After Tomorrow.
Okay.
And maybe that'll come to me as we talk.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, I helped out on a robot.
Did you do any XXX stuff?
I did not. I was not.
Did you do any? Oh, did he do a Star Trek thing?
There it is. Thank you. Yes. So I worked on Trek, and I think I might have been a lighting supervisor.
Okay.
Or lighting lead. I was a lighting lead. So
within four shows, you became a CG supervisor over there.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Again, I don't know why DD was as good to me as it was, but I'm grateful for it.
When I walked into that job, I was nervous about it.
Yeah.
Because, again, I don't necessarily have the experience, and I know that I have been told for so long that you don't have the proper experience.
Yeah.
It's like, we're interested in like what you're doing, but you have to have production experience, or you have to have this and that. And you were the first person like, no, you get it.
Yeah.
And so I was relieved because I was looking to you as like, well, if ever I have a question, I can just, you know, Andy will be able to talk me off the ledge about this.
Yeah.
And I remember one time specifically where I was like, I don't know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't know. And he's like, it's like, neither do I. I'm sure we'll figure it out.
Well, I think there was the architecture school look in your eye.
Yeah.
There is something that we share, which is there is a sort of element of production.
Right.
You know, in charretting to get
a
project done in school. So, you know, I was pretty confident that we were going to figure stuff out. And, you know, that was such an incredible time when the industry literally was exploding, and to sort of zoom out a little, the thing that I loved about all that stuff was no one was trained to do it. You know, like everybody, we were sort of the last generation that wasn't trained to do CG.
Right,
and
now there's a lot of schools.
Yeah, I mean, and there were people who went to fine art school, and there were people who were, you know, science-based and math-based, and people who just did it because they were obsessive and interested in technology. And that was an incredible thing for me to sort of be a part of this, all this change that was happening. So, you know, like every show we would be at a place where we were like, how are we going to do this? You know, no one's been trained to do this. The technology is being invented literally every, you know, couple of months. Some new thing is coming out. And
right.
That was just it was an incredible time. And I remember the sort of excitement of ramping up for Day After Tomorrow and talking about things like LiDAR scanning 8 city blocks in Manhattan.
Yep.
And we came up with this very elaborate sort of asset management booklet of, all right, how are we going to scan this and how many angles do we need and how many textures are we going to paint? And it was like a probably like an inch thick bound paper thing that our integration guys took with them to New York, and I suspect it wasn't useful at all. But we really tried hard.
Yeah.
Our heart was in the right place.
Yeah, but that was a cool thing. Like you said, that all the people, especially if you look at all the people that were on Day After Tomorrow. I mean, you have the architect, you have the rocket scientist inside of Matthew Butler,
yeah.
You had the kid that grew up from Brooklyn and Brian Graham. Yeah. And Brian, by the way, has been on this podcast.
Yeah, of course.
And so he's got on great stories, and people really love those stories.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of a cool, everyone has a little bit of a different unusual story to them.
Yeah, and the other supervisors, Sean Faden. David Prescott. Yeah. That was a great group of people.
Yeah, and that's the thing I remember. It was my first show, and it was such a crazy show, as we all know. And I've heard Scott Ross say it. Let's go back to that podcast if you want to hear what actually happened on that show. He doesn't hold back. But the thing that I always appreciated is the fact that you guys didn't necessarily mask what was going on, but you reassured us that we will – everything is going to be okay. Yeah. So you burdened yourself with the pain, but without us feeling like they're holding something back. I don't know what they're holding back. No, you told us what was going on, but then you didn't make us feel like it was our fault or anything else, because it wasn't really.
Yeah. No, I mean it was a very hardworking, very passionate group of people,
and I
think everybody sort of understood that we have success together, and so we're gonna get through this, and we're gonna do the best work we can, sort of independent of whatever sort of political things are happening.
Yeah,
and I think some great work got done.
I'm absolutely
very proud of everybody. I mean the modeling team, the painting team, all the lighting guys that sort of were under my wing. It's a bad description, but they did amazing stuff. I mean, we built an incredible model of New York City.
And
that was really fun to do.
Yeah, I didn't realize. It was the first time when I left, since I left architect. That was the funny thing, right?
Yeah.
So I was an architect doing CG and architects. So there are lots of architects in an architecture firm. So my specialty is CG.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly I'm working in a group of people that everyone knows CG, but they don't necessarily know a lot of architecture.
Yeah.
So suddenly you said, Chris, you do some architecture here.
Yeah.
So you made me design buildings or make the architectural decisions on buildings that people didn't logically have.
Yeah.
So I felt more like an architect working at Digital Domain than I did when I was working in architecture.
Nice.
Because I remember we came up with that weird block system for New York City.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's huge value in sort of having specialists doing that kind of work, because sort of there were tons of great artists who could make a thing that looked like a building, but when it came to sort of how a window meets a piece of stone or something like that, people probably wouldn't think that through.
Mm-hmm.
But having a sense of what the technology behind construction is makes it more real when you're doing the visual effects version of it.
Right.
It was nice to sort of have someone other than me who was sort of informed and could do.
Yeah, you told me to go speak to we're looking at some of the textures, because we had all these generic buildings that were being done for just filling in the rest of the city. And you looked at some of the textures and you're like, that doesn't make sense. And I said, yeah. And then I said, okay, you go talk to the texture guys and explain to them a little bit about this. And I did, and they were great about it.
Yeah.
But I basically said, okay, see this building? It's like this wall here that's not on the street, that's usually a wall that's a party wall.
Right.
And so on this wall, you want to have, and he said, and I just showed him pictures, like, you see how those windows go crisscross? That's because there's a stairway. And then they started imagining, it's like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
It's like, you see this top floor? It's usually the windows are bigger on that because it's a mechanical floor.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh. Yeah. And so once they had just a few rules, it wasn't just a slap on a bunch of windows on a building.
Yeah.
They had a reason for doing that.
Yeah.
And it was very easy,
but
they just needed someone to tell them that. And I guess that's the thing. Half an hour with them, and it was a massive difference in terms of just – and they did great textures. That's something I couldn't do.
Yeah.
But I just gave them the tools that I – gave them the rules of what they would do for the building. So it ended up being really, really kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like that. It was fun. You gave me some really great tasks that right off the bat, he's like, all right, you're going to come up with the way to create all these background buildings that no one's going to see, but a system for doing that. And that was fun.
Yeah.
And then I worked on the the snowy buildings for a while,
yes,
which never made it to the movie.
It's all part of the development.
It was part of the development, yeah. But it was a great thing.
Yeah.
Then we worked on iRobot for a little bit, but you decided you didn't want to do our lead position anymore. You wanted to sort of hang out in the background and do lighting a little bit, right? Didn't work out so well for you, by the way, because you ended up leading.
I was burned out. I mean, that's really what happened was I got really burned out after Day After Tomorrow. Again, DD was really generous and said, just cool out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Let me sort of help out with some architecture on iRobot.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were two other kind of quick shows that they let me supervise.
Oh, the Eon Flux one.
I helped out on Flux, but I don't even know if I got a credit, which I wouldn't have deserved. I did a show called Dark Water, mm-hmm. and I did Cinderella Man.
Ah.
And they were smaller shows, you know, a few set extensions, some visual effects stuff. It was more like a sort of a small group of generalist artists, and we kind of did whatever was needed.
Right.
But at that point, I was really burned out, and I felt like, okay, I need to sort of get away from this for a while. And so I left DD, and it was bittersweet. And I still have my pirate flag with all the signatures on it.
Yeah.
And I went back to architecture.
Okay. Now, this is the thing that's very interesting, because obviously this is a rare story. There's a lot of architects or ex-architects in visual effects.
Uh-huh.
There aren't many architects that came back to architecture after visual effects. You're probably one of the only people I know, and you're a successful one at that too, which is great.
That's relative. But
yeah, that's relative. But okay, so let's start with your architecture route. Where did you study architecture?
I got a graduate degree at a school called SciArch, which is the Southern California Institute of Architecture.
Very good school.
And there were some great instructors there, and some of them
Robert Mangurian and Marion Ray, as I remember very well.
Yeah, they were, I think they taught my first semester of graduate school, which was a very hard, that sort of shock of the first semester when they kind of by fire.
Mm-hmm. So did you get your master's over there?
I got my master's
Did you
there.
Get a bachelor before that at a different school, or did you
I
just
got
do
a liberal arts degree?
Oh, okay.
But so I did junior year when all my friends sort of went overseas and were exploring. I went to art school.
Okay.
And because I, you know, I always kind of knew architecture, but maybe furniture design or industrial design. Mm-hmm. So I did my junior year away at art school, and then after that, I was like, I need to commit to architecture, and it just seemed somehow like I should get 2 degrees instead of one because I make things harder than I should.
Sure.
So I finished my bachelor's and then went to graduate school, went to SciArch, got out. I had played with computers and did probably one of the first sort of all 3D sets of drawings for my thesis, which might have been like Dyna Perspective. Maybe it was StratVision. Anyway, it was 1989, 1990.
Right.
There was not a lot of
nope.
of ability to draw 3D with a computer.
Yeah. That's when I was in high school.
Yeah, I'm old. And I feel it.
Yeah. It must have been just literally just wireframe possibly.
No, it was early texture mapping.
It was
all
really?
pixelated, and like something that, you know, kids now would say, "Ooh, that's cool," because it's so sort of poorly made. But at the time, it was pretty high tech. Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it was pretty gruesome.
Right.
Or my memory of it is gruesome. I should maybe try to dig it up and see. But anyway.
Huh.
So there was a component of that. Sense of exploration and computers and technology and for whatever reason, when I got out of school, there was a little bit of a recession happening, and I had this ability to do it was more sort of like Photoshop type stuff, and I ended up getting a couple jobs in art department doing art department style stuff.
Yep.
I did like these fake travel posters for a Rob Reiner movie called North, which, you know, probably no one ever saw. But, you know, it was one of those things. And it was you could sort of see this sort of swell because, you know, before to do a poster that looked like a movie poster, they had to hire an illustrator and it was this sort of expensive thing. Mm-hmm. And I could do five of these things in a week and they were like, ooh, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. So you know, that led to some motion graphics and all of that sort of led to the feature animation and then visual effects. But
so do you never practiced architecture between graduating CyArk and going to visual effects?
I did. I mean,
did you work at an architecture firm?
No, not really. I kept all my architecture connections and all my architecture friends. And so one thing that happened when I first got exposed to these very powerful tools, the Silicon Graphics machines and Softimage, mm-hmm. I called up a buddy of mine who used to do these incredible, crazy ink drawings, a guy named Neil Denari. Mm-hmm. And I said, you have to see this because this is going to change how you do your drawings. Right. And we ended up sort of collaborating on some stuff and really did, because of him, I'll say some groundbreaking sort of visualization for architecture.
Okay.
That wasn't about me. That was about him. But so there was architecture sort of interwoven in all of this. And it wasn't like I was so busy all the time getting hired to do movie stuff that I didn't have time to do other things. I mean, it was my 20s. I was, you know, unemployed for 2 months and sort of thinking, okay, well, should I try to do architecture? Should I try to not? And I had gotten some small jobs. I helped a director sort of design a little space for his production company, but it was very sort of minor stuff. Mm-hmm. But I never worked in a firm. I was never sort of – I'm not good at sort of being a soldier in that way. So I never sort of kind of got the job and sat behind the desk and, you know, drew window details. That I don't have the temperament to do that very well.
Yeah, but you still practice really cool architecture. Because so the first time I've experienced your architecture was I knew you had bought this plot of land, I guess, right off the Venice Boardwalk, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's about it's in an alley basically between Venice Boardwalk and Main Street, right?
Right?
Yeah. And not far from DD, like stone's throw from DD or the old DD.
Yeah.
Stone's throw from Google.
Yeah.
So what was cool about the way you did it is it's almost the simplest idea of design in a really well executed way.
Wow.
Because you just basically took your direct angle space and you just like chopped it in half and said, this half is going to be the residence in one side and then I'm going to take the other half and chop that in two halves and create two rental units.
Yeah.
But those rental units is like, oh, these are long, thin buildings in a way. But you made them beautiful because like you walked in, it felt grandiose because of the tall, high ceilings and the bathroom, which is like a skylight all the way up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you walk in this bathroom. It's a small bathroom, but it feels huge because it has this tall ceiling to it.
Yeah. Yeah, we had some fun with that. I mean, it's nice to sort of – there weren't a lot of opportunities because it was a small project, but to sort of take a shower in a little narrow slot of space that happens to be two stories tall and has a skylight at the top is fun.
It feels really nice. I mean, just to help, since this is an audio podcast, just help visualize. Imagine you're in a space that's about a meter wide or so, and probably about 3 meters, 4 meters long.
Maybe a little less, but not big.
And that's your entire bathroom, but that feels a little small, cramped, but you can look up two stories and into a skylight. So it feels like you're in a small cathedral in a sense, you know?
You know, I had gone to Japan for a semester during graduate school, and that had a profound effect on me because the sort of the Japanese sensibility about sort of finding spatial opportunities mm-hmm. is so not American. And it's Americans have sort of adopted much more of it, and you know, the sort of available media has sort of blurred the lines between what different cultural ideas about space were. I mean, mm-hmm. everything is being globalized. But anyway, I learned a lot about sort of how to try to find ways to make things interesting in small spaces from being in Japan, where where spaces are smaller.
Right.
And so that had a huge influence on me. And so that was sort of the thing that kind of kicked me in the pants and said, hey, you should, you know, just because you're making a small studio space doesn't mean you can't find ways to try to make it interesting.
Right. And you did the same thing in your own house, in the sense that basically your whole entire front of it is a huge garage door, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like our garage door here.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But
you guys are copying me.
I do think about it when we open that door, that suddenly everything feels so much bigger. So when you open this door, your like entire house is exposed to or becomes part of the outside.
Yeah. So the smell of urine is wafting in from the alley.
from the Venice Beach and
yes.
Yeah, and the smell of dead fish and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a really cool design, and I love the colors of it. I remember it was just really, really cool space.
Thank you.
And you've continued to practice architecture now. So for how long have you been – you've got your own firm?
Firm is a loose word. I practice. Mm-hmm. It's been really interesting because it's sort of a cart and horse thing. Almost 90%, I would say, of my work is for production companies.
Right.
And one of the things that I think – has helped me get this work is the fact that I have done a lot of production.
Right.
And so I can go to these companies and talk about Avid Bays and talk about editing equipment and talk about sort of production methodologies and yeah, I'm making up a lot of it, but sure. But at least I've had some actual experience.
Yeah.
And that informs the conversations that we have about what they want their spaces to be. So it's not like anything that I planned.
No.
But the fact that I've had a fair amount of production experience sort of has really helped a lot. So I've made a lot of spaces for production people.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been to Bad Robot. Now, wasn't that part of one of your designs that helped make some of that stuff?
Yes. I worked with an incredible with a firm that's downtown called Shimoda Design Group.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who runs it, his name is Joey Shimoda, and he and I have known each other for, I don't know, it's more than 20 years.
Right.
Bad Robot came to us and said, we're making a space, and it was much more than I can handle.
Right.
So I did, you know, get to play a part in making that space. And,
right.
And that was – it was a really interesting collaboration both with Joey Shimoda and with Bad Robot, because the sort of triangle of the three personalities was – everyone was pushing everyone, mm-hmm. you know, and there was a huge amount of ambition, and there's a little bit of the Japan thing as well with the sort of the programming of the Bad Robot space, because mm-hmm. there was a limited amount of space. It was under 20,000 square feet.
Oh, really?
But the sort of desire in terms of how many different kinds of things they wanted to do in there
right.
was 30,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. So we were forced to sort of smash things together and say, well, what happens if your screening room is also a conference room and it's also a war room? Mm-hmm. And so we kind of came up with a way to have whiteboards that disappear in the room, but then also had to work with the acoustic engineers to make sure that that didn't get somehow influenced by, you know, low frequency from right. the sort of incredible sound system they have there, and so it was incredibly interesting and educational, and there was a lot of discussion about sort of narrative in architecture that was sort of relevant to storytelling and things that I had experienced with visual effects, and it became a sort of a very recursive experience because, you know, different things were feeding other things, and those in turn were sort of being fed by a third thing that somehow all I had been lucky enough to experience all these sort of various worlds, and they were coming together in one place. So,
yeah, what I like about that space when you walk in, obviously, it tries very hard to sort of get you into your geek mode, right?
Like, yes. Like
When you go in there, it's like it's seducing you with all of its little geekness, right? But not over the top, right?
Yeah.
In a sense that it feels very welcoming.
Yeah, and that was. That was deliberate, and that came from Bad Robot. It was really interesting because obviously they're storytellers, and not having ever built anything, they sort of approached architecture like a narrative thing. Mm-hmm. And so when you walk in the door, that was literally described as, this is the establishing shot. This is the wide shot.
Yeah.
And I want to see as many different things and build momentum and excitement and curiosity with this shot, because we don't have the money to sort of make every little nook and cranny amazing. But if you come in with the wide shot, mm-hmm. then the close-ups and the reverse can be less interesting,
right?
Because you've set the scene. And it was this sort of really interesting kind of mapping of narrative and storytelling onto architecture. And I've never forgotten that.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because maybe we can sidetrack a little bit, because this is something that I think is very important in terms of architecture. There's been a lot of discussion about VR recently, uh-huh.
yeah.
and I'm ad nauseum. but one of the things I always bring up is the fact that, you know, everyone seems to be trying to shoehorn narrative into uh-huh. a virtual reality experience, uh-huh. and they're trying to do this, and it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Now take that idea and put that on one side.
Sure.
And the second idea is that virtual reality is really about taking you to a place that you've never seen before.
Yes.
Which is really what an architect does when they're trying to describe a space.
Yeah.
And when I think about that, and I've always thought about this, even mm-hmm. in architecture school, mm-hmm. and just the way you just described that Bad Robot, architects' jobs are a narrative job.
Yeah.
They describe your feeling, emotions, views, trajectory, journey through a space.
Sure.
It is a narrative.
Yeah.
And it's not linear either, necessarily.
No, it's very much not linear.
Right.
Some of it can be, but there are always alternate ways of moving through a space.
And so I think that the way that architects describe stories is much better for a VR experience.
Yeah.
Than what they're trying to shoehorn a linear story, third-person experience that cinema is.
Yeah.
So I think that just the way you described how you described the going into the space mm-hmm. in these little pockets of windows,
yeah.
I think is great, because I think it's the idea of architecture. The way it's described is good. Do you feel that you've changed the way you talk about architecture since working in movies?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, I suppose it's inevitable,
sure.
right? Because movies are such a big part of my experience that, and I've learned so much from the people I was around, you know, talking about all these incredible people like Matthew and Brian, David and Sean and, mm-hmm. and you and, so there, I think it's inevitable that that happened. I don't know that there was sort of a deliberate shift in the way the language comes, but I think that it's impossible not to be influenced by something that you sort of spend such a kind of intense period of time doing.
But do you ever find yourself like putting your fingers up and then looking at a space through like a lens in a way?
I maybe. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, sure. I mean, part of me doesn't want to sort of think about architecture as the kind of commodity of the image and publication and the internet and all that stuff, because architecture is so much more. But there, it's hard not to kind of move your head to kind of compose, oh, those things align a little better if I'm standing here versus standing somewhere else. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's not me so much as there's a natural connection between film, the medium of film, mm-hmm. in architecture.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, architecture is our environment. So it's very hard to tell a story that's not really in an environment.
Yeah.
So I think those things are connected. But to sort of back up to the VR thing, which I think is really interesting, and I've started playing with it. Uh-huh. I got the developer's kit for the Oculus.
Yeah.
And did a presentation.
Uh-huh.
With the help of some DD people, with the help of Melanie Okamura, yeah, and Hansi Tang.
Nice.
We did a presentation, and it's going to have a profound effect on architecture. There's no doubt about it.
I agree 100%. In fact, what upsets me a little bit is that the VR community has 100% focused on games and film, and I think that that's the wrong...
Yeah, but that, I mean, I think you have to be honest about where the business opportunities are.
But why isn't it architecture?
Because architecture is a losing proposition. Nobody makes a good living being an architect.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I've worked in visual effects and, you know, and the profit margins and stuff on films and risk in films is big.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think it's the right medium. I think people just think, oh, well, people like movies. Yeah. I think there's something seductive about it.
Yeah.
I think that architects can play a role in virtual reality.
Yeah.
I think that architects can, if you go to see, you've seen a bunch of VR content, I'm sure, mm-hmm, somehow,
yeah,
and it all looks like crap because they're not designed by people who know what the hell they're doing.
It's the exact same thing we were talking about when we started, which is the architects haven't been doing it yet, right?
Right.
So films weren't good until the artists, films have always been good, but visual effects got better when it was less about people who were strictly trained as engineers and more the people who were trained with, say, a fine arts background or a photography background could become part of the conversation that was making visual effects.
Right.
And VR is the same way. I mean, the technology is still a little bit it's still forming.
Right.
But more and more, as architects get their hands on this stuff, the architectural experiences are going to get more and more interesting.
Yeah. I agree. And I actually think that architects, that people who are putting money into VR content and getting stuff that looks mediocre should look at investing in architects to design new, because I think VR is a new real estate space.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so there's no reason, and I know a lot of architects are like, why would I build something that never gets built? It's like, you know, I don't know. I'd love to see a John Haydock VR experience, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it's interesting.
Or Bernard Schumi or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, you totally. When I go back and the experience with Neil Denari that I was talking about earlier, when I go back and think about that, and sort of think about how you and I were trained literally with a straight edge and a pencil.
Yep.
And after sort of playing with 3D software, my innate sort of ability to think in perspective, mm-hmm, I got trained by doing the computer work, which seems backwards. It feels like if the computer's doing all the work for you, you should have less ability to sort of think in 3D perspective.
Right.
But what I found was it trained me to sort of see stuff, and I could draw a perspective so much better after playing with 3D software.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that will happen with VR too. Like, I don't know sort of in the sort of big abstract world how VR affects everything, but I do think, like, as a student, the ability to visualize in this way is going to train people, even when they're not using the goggles, it'll train people to imagine things that aren't necessarily easy to imagine without that stuff.
Yeah.
To me, that's incredibly interesting, and that's where the power of that tool comes in.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of people that were talking about specifically how, you know, architects, the way, well, you were just mentioning the perspective thing, but when you design a building, a lot of you start with little sketches on a piece of paper or a little piece of model.
Yeah.
So it's very much like a small object, right?
Yeah, totally.
And it's not a space.
Yeah.
You're designing a small sculpture and you're making it, and then you try to imagine yourself inside the building, but that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
With VR, you can, at the very early stages, immediately be inside that space and understand scale. So that's going to massively affect your design decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right on the nose. I mean, you can sort of I don't even know if this will make sense, but you can sort of sketch space.
Yes.
You can sort of, in a very sort of quick way, be inside of a thing, which you could never do with a pencil and a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the ability to iterate and the ability to sort of be obsessive in a whole different way will be, you know, profoundly altered by,
sure,
by having these tools.
And I think right now people are trying to figure out the tools of like, how do I move walls while, yeah, in virtual reality and, yeah, stuff. And I think that will eventually come. I'm not sold on the way people are thinking about interfaces yet.
Yeah.
But at the very least, you can be on your computer, you can move a wall, yeah, real quick, put on the headset and check,
yeah,
it out. You,
yeah,
know?
It's fantastic.
And I think that's going to change the way people think about space. What's interesting, yeah, now is from our customers is we've sort of given them the ability. We have this thing called a stereo cube map, which people can do, which basically is just a nodal 360 view, but, uh-huh, it's true stereo.
Yeah.
So,
nice.
And it's a render.
Okay.
So it's fully very photoreal,
cool,
ray trace render.
Yeah.
But what they've done is they said that 75% of their renders now are, uh-huh, that instead of,
wow,
stills.
Yeah.
Because it's so much more informative to their customers. They can go, it's, yeah, like, oh, you want to see what it looks like? Here,
yeah,
put this on. And,
yeah,
and that is way more informative,
yeah,
to them than seeing a rendering,
yeah,
on a piece of paper.
And the nodal thing is cool, but it's an intermediate step.
It is an intermediate step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The real sort of nerdy part of me that the first time I put the goggles on, it's the best part about the goggles is sort of the way it plugs into your spinal column. Like when you shift your weight and you get the parallax moving,
yep,
there's some sort of animalistic thing that, I mean, talk about suspension of disbelief. Like,
mm-hmm,
you know, in your consciousness that you're in a conference room, but every part of your sensory experience is I'm in this other space and I,
yeah,
can walk around in here. And you know, if you take three steps, you're walking into the table,
yeah,
but your body just wants to do it anyway. And the shift from the nodal render to that full 3D is so, so strong.
Absolutely. And that's, if you guys want to know more about the 6 degrees of freedom,
yeah,
you can go back to listen to our No Zone podcast, which will, it has not come out yet, but will have come out by the time this one comes out. But those guys do a system where they basically give you 6 degrees of freedom,
yeah,
of a fully rendered space.
It's amazing.
They do it inside a box. It's kind of an interesting, I'll have to show you the demo of that, but it's really cool.
Cool.
But I love, you're right. I think that's good. I didn't even plan to talk about VR today, so we're good. But okay, so, you talked about how your visual effects experience has influenced your architecture in terms of just literally knowing how production works,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so most it's like, oh,
yeah,
I understand this,
yeah,
customer better because, yeah, of this experience.
Yep.
You also talked about, you know, the language. Obviously, you're able to have a language with the people about how they describe things. So if they speak to you about framing a shot, establishing,
yeah,
shots,
yeah, yeah,
that was good. Obviously, your knowledge of how VR works must also come from a lot of your CG background too. So you're probably very interested in that from that perspective as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it goes back to that sort of sense of discovery that we were talking about,
right,
with Day After Tomorrow and Digital Domain, and that sort of wonderful sense of let's figure out how to do this, because you can't just order the version of X. We have to invent it ourselves.
Right.
And I think VR is, you know, one of the things that's really exciting. I mean, and it's not for the sort of fetish of it. I'm not interested in the goggles because of the goggles. I'm interested in the goggles because it's a way to explore something in a new way,
right?
Like the sort of the design of the architecture that you're experiencing through the goggles.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's important.
Sure.
The fact that you're looking at it through goggles is cool, but if you're looking at something that's sort of not interesting,
mm-hmm,
then to me that's fetish. And so, the thing that I'm interested in is sort of exploring the thing and understanding point of view and narrative and some of the stuff we were talking about that makes architecture good, exploring that through what I think is going to be sort of the next way for people to visualize architecture. I mean, the difference between an old sort of hand-drawn render and a CG render is sort of, it's a paradigm shift. And I think the difference between...
Yeah, but it's almost become expected now.
Like yeah.
Photorealistic yeah. architecture is, yeah. is I mean, you talked about this with Jeff Muddle. It's a solved problem in a sense. Yeah. Architects have nailed photorealistic
yeah.
stuff done properly.
Yeah.
But... I think that there is something about technology that's important in terms of where technology is going to bring architecture design. Uh-huh. And I've been trying to find, besides VR, because it almost seems too obvious that VR is the next thing. Mm-hmm. But I want to know what that next thing is. What is going to make architecture change? What's going to be the next wave of architecture? Mm-hmm. How is technology going to change stuff? Because, you know, yeah. obviously engineering changed yeah. it, yeah. went from stone to metal.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big yeah. thing. Then obviously some level of architecture changed. But I think now architecture has become so commoditized.
Yes. And that frightens me. And I mean, to me, you know, when you're talking about what's next in architecture, I think... I don't know, mm-hmm. but what I would say is I have an agenda.
What's your agenda?
I'd like the world to, you know, be a better place, and that's a stupid cliche, but
or less ugly.
Well, yeah, always. That's sort of a given. My hope is if you do something good, it will last longer. So this whole idea of design as a commodity, mm-hmm. when you go to the mall and you see the sort of latest facade of whatever shop yeah. where you buy a thing that you're going to throw away in 6 months, on some level, the facade of the building is also something they're going to throw away in 6 months.
Yeah.
So to me, the agenda is...
The same thing with movies nowadays
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
You know, movies are like, I can barely remember the movies that came out last yeah. year because there's so many
yeah.
of them.
Yeah.
And they're all the same.
Yeah. So the desire is quality that will sort of transcend commodity.
Right.
And I'm a liberal guy, so I want architecture to be more efficient, and I want, you know, people to be more comfortable in cities, and I want to solve homelessness, mm-hmm. not me, the royal me. Mm-hmm. I want homelessness to be solved, you
right.
know. So social agendas and economic agendas. I mean, this is probably sort of getting off topic. I don't know what's next, but I think trying to do the right thing using the coolest, newest tools,
right?
You get some traction, you know.
I think there. Well, listen, I always find that there's a way using the knowledge we have, mm-hmm. right, that we can find interesting ways to solve problems that we feel strongly about.
Yeah.
You brought up the idea of homelessness I'm just using that as an example.
Sure.
Or just making housing more affordable
yeah.
and easier.
Yeah.
And still have cool architecture designs,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Have you heard of the WikiHouse project?
Sure, of course.
And that's a
really
perfect
cool.
example,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You make really beautiful design and
yeah.
you open source the design
yeah.
and make
yeah.
it just rapid prototyping
yeah.
of some kind.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool technology. I think
yeah.
I'd love to see more of that because that project, you hear about it, but it's not like it's taken
yeah.
over the world, right?
Yeah. No, it's not, unfortunately. I think that's right. And I also think, you know, giving to fundraising, right?
Right.
So getting the goggles on someone who can make a difference and being able to, in a very compelling way, tell the story of here's how you should help people who don't have a home, that's a powerful thing and,
sure.
and something not to be overlooked. And so, I think there's a way to sort of to use these tools to help whatever your agenda is.
Okay.
And I think it's going to be really interesting. I'm excited. You know, I'm excited to see what happens with all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be cool to go over that. Okay. So I don't know if you know much about what I do in labs. I do weird stuff. That's kind of
immediately exciting.
Yeah. And so in order to organize all these crazy thoughts I had mm-hmm. had to sort of classify them or put them in little bins, right? Yeah. So one of the first bins I had, I have a passion about understanding digital humans, and I've been doing this, and that was ever since I sort of went back to DD the second time, and I worked with Eric Barba and all those guys and started looking at digital humans.
Yeah.
And so I have this digital human group that I call, actually we call it the Digital Human League because it's funnier that way. And then I like the term league because every time it sounds like superheroes. Yeah. So we'll just say Digital Human League. And then we have Digital Film League where we're trying to solve film problems with technology. Uh-huh. We're using some really weird stuff like virtual production tools, et cetera. Uh-huh. And then the third group, which is hasn't really have official home yet, but there's some really cool people in it. And it includes like Eric Hansen.
I was just thinking about him.
Yeah, Eric Hansen and then Kim Bauman-Larsen. I don't know if you know Kim.
No.
He's a really cool guy. And a couple of other architecture type people.
Yeah.
And obviously people at like companies like Gensler and stuff who I'm most interested in getting.
Yeah.
But just about thinking about how technology can influence design and how and it doesn't have to be directly related to rendering, but it's, you know, obviously anything that we can help on.
Yeah.
And so thinking about if you have some really interesting thoughts about architecture or design and how technology can work to help that process in an interesting way, be it through virtual reality, rapid prototyping, whatever it is, to solve, you know, even down to the socioeconomic levels of housing.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about them.
Wow.
Because that's something that I'm passionate about as well. Yeah. And our architecture group has got some pretty cool, interesting ideas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think at the sort of most base, simplistic level, the ability to visualize something in a compelling way quickly is hugely valuable.
Sure.
I mean, my practice is very small, and I'll sit there, model something in SketchUp, render it with V-Ray, and get it to someone really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a powerful thing. I mean, that's there's some wonderful sort of democracy to that.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the root of any sort of wave of change is sort of people who have a sense of what they want the world to be and the ability to start changing things.
Right.
I've never really thought about it, you know, how is architecture sort of going to change the world and make it better, other than sort of wanting the world to be better. But I suppose there's this kind of subtext or this undercurrent of I have these amazing tools and I have an ability to do this myself. I'm not a technical person. You know, I'm an art school guy. I'm not a math school guy.
Yeah.
But the fact that these tools become more and more powerful and that someone like me can sort of pick up SketchUp and then very quickly get the model done and then very quickly get a render done that looks cool.
Right. Well, I'm going to go back to what you told me earlier because we're both architects. And I think the thing about you learn very quickly in architecture is not to be afraid of the unknown, right?
Yeah.
Just because something is – you don't understand it. You're constantly having to like. It's like, oh, you got to design a hospital. It's like I don't know anything about hospitals. Yeah. It's like, well, don't worry, I'll learn about it, right?
And that to me, there's an interesting sort of parallel there with filmmaking because with filmmaking, it's like okay, you get a bunch of really smart people together, visual effects filmmaking. You get a bunch of really smart people together, and it's like okay, we're going to learn about what a frozen city is going to look like now.
Right.
And so we're just like, all right, well, we're going to just very quickly learn how to do this the way you'd very quickly learn how to make a hospital.
Right.
Although a hospital is a real thing.
And, and there's no lives on the line.
Yeah. Although sometimes it would feel like that with production.
Yeah. But but it's true. We do. Yeah. We do kind of like, you know, it's almost the definition of visual effects is we want to see something we've never seen before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a similar problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. I had another couple of things.
Okay.
You know, I think we covered most of the things and more, which has been incredible. Right. Is there any other cool stuff that you want to tell us about some cool spaces we can look at? Are you going to be able to give me some images of some of your architecture that I can put on our podcast page?
So yeah, people can see I suppose.
Yeah.
yeah, of course.
It'd be good to do that.
Right.
And actually, my question about to you about the digital design stuff in terms of thinking about it. You don't have to answer that now, but I want you to think. If you can, think about it in the future.
Yeah,
because it's really, I've got some really great ideas of what we can do. And
love that.
And you're using SketchUp and V-Ray, which is already going to put you in a good spot to try some new technology.
Oh, good.
So it should be cool. We've got some interesting ideas coming up. So,
I can't wait.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to give our sign off, which is we're going to let the last bucket drop.
Okay. I like it.
And I really appreciate you coming by, Andy. Thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Thank you.